Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Lavelle Brown. Brown is a graduate of the University of Virginia, where he earned his PhD in education leadership. He currently serves as the superintendent of the Ithaca City School District in Ithaca, New York. Prior to his appointment, he held the position of Central Information Officer for the Albemarle County Public School District in Charlottesville, Virginia, and was also the Executive Director of School Improvement. He has held many posts in public education, working as a teacher, assistant principal, as well as a principal. Dr. Brown is an active member of many professional organizations, including the International Society for Technology in Education and the New York State Council of School Superintendents. And welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on today.
You've been involved in education in one way or another all of your adult life, it seems. What made you get into this profession? What drove the passion for this?
Thanks for asking. It actually goes back to childhood. My mother was an educator, and she just recently retired after 44 years in classrooms.
Wow.
She started off in a very rural school district in Virginia in the 60s. So I've always been around education and watching her be an educator. And seeing the powerful, the powerful impact educators have had on my life, and I'm hoping we can talk more about that later. That's what prompted me to continue in this field and to hope to make a difference for other young people myself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you went from teaching into being an administrator.
Yeah.
You know, you segued into that field. Did you miss teaching? Did you consciously decide to do that, or did it just fall in your lap?
It sort of naturally happened. I think folks saw leadership in me and pushed me to get into administration, but I see myself teaching every day still.
Uh-huh.
I'm leading by walking around. I'm in classrooms every day. I'm working with young people every day. I'm working with adults and community members every day, helping them understand the mission, vision, and this approach of teaching and learning that we embrace here. But, yes, I've always thought of myself as a teacher, even from going back to 6th or 7th grade. I saw myself being in front of young people, teaching and helping them be better students and helping build relationships.
Yeah, yeah. Having been a teacher, do you feel like you had an extra sensitivity to what you needed to be as a superintendent?
Yes. Having listened to my mother for decades complain about administrators, principals, superintendents, and what they did that really didn't make sense. Everything from cutting the arts and athletics first when it came to budget crunch time to not paying teachers appropriately. I had to listen to that growing up.
Yeah.
And so when thinking about making a difference in affecting policy and setting priorities, I leave from that background today. So, yes, I've been around it.
Yeah, I know. I hear all kinds of complaints about administration from various teachers. You know, nobody can be perfect.
Yeah, nobody
but,
can.
Yeah, the expectations are quite high, I'm sure. Now, what do you think is the key to being an effective superintendent?
Humility, coming into this work and knowing that you do not have all the answers, but are willing to learn from other educators and community members and young people about how to become a better educator. I went into teaching as a reading teacher, and I was able to teach hundreds of young people how to read.
Mm.
I have a 2-year-old at home that I know now I won't be able to teach how to read because she learns differently than I or the young people I taught. She's a digital native. She's accustomed to swiping, touching, having real-time access to data, multimedia. That's how she learns. The way I taught reading didn't incorporate that.
Right.
So now I'm struggling to help her, but I'm adapting. I'm reading much, I'm practicing, I'm doing different things. I'm adapting my teaching style to meet her needs. So in this role of as superintendent, humility and understanding that we will never have all the answers because our young people are changing every day, I think that's helping me bring people together. It's helping me lead some change, and it's helping me communicate to young people and help them feel like they know we are here for them.
Uh-huh. Did you have to go into a big learning curve to learn about the culture in Ithaca when you first came here from
Ithaca's
West Virginia?
Unique, as we all know.
Yes.
But I've grown up in a college town. I grew up right outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. I went to the University of Virginia, so I'm accustomed to college towns. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain dynamic that exists in those places. There are many opinions. People are passionate about education. They expect excellence in education. Rarely do they thank you for it, but they expect excellence in education. So I've grown up in that culture, and I've been a part of it all my life. So coming to Ithaca and being a part of that here has been no different. And what's also good about being here in Ithaca, I grew up, like I said, just outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, in a very rural part there. So I grew up poor, rural, and I had all the risk factors many of our young people here have in some of our outlying areas outside of the city proper. So having an understanding of that And growing up in that has helped me adapt to the Ithaca community as well.
Yeah, yeah. There's no way to, you know, discount personal experience when you're teaching kids. Mm-hmm. Now, the Ithaca City School District has something called the Equity Report Card. Tell us what it is and how it's working.
Yeah, and it's been around for many, many years. It was actually something that I knew about prior to even thinking about being superintendent in Ithaca. And it's an annual report card that tracks certain indicators that give us a sense of how equitable our opportunities are for young people. Everything from co-curricular enrollment patterns to standardized test scores, attendance and discipline. Those are indicators that the report card captured annually. In addition to the report card, we've now shifted to a more dynamic approach to looking at performance indicators. We now do something called a balanced scorecard, and we update indicators quarterly. So attendance data, discipline data, achievement data on the multiple measures that we use to determine achievement, we're looking at quarterly, and you can access that information online from our website. You can manipulate the data in ways to get to the membership group or the cohorts that you wish to get to. Ithaca was out in front of that work before with the Equity Report Card, putting data out there for everyone to see and confronting some brutal facts. Now that we've moved to this balanced scorecard that's dynamic and out there for everyone to see and it's manipulatable and it's online, we're even further out in front of most other school districts.
How is it compiled? Are teachers involved? Are parents involved?
Starting at the teacher level, we give performance assessments out. We've created assessments that are common across the district that go after critical thinking. Those performance assessments are of high quality. We think are better, much better than the state assessments. Uh-huh. So our teachers administer those to our young people. That data is then put into systems that are updated dynamically. That data is then available to teachers, administrators, and the community within seconds. And so our balanced scorecard, you're now able to see data based on our assessments, attendance data that is dynamic, discipline data that's dynamic. So whatever indicator that we're using or looking at, we're able to see updated quarterly, and it's at all levels we're using it.
I see. So you can see patterns, good and bad, and make change accordingly.
Data's most meaningful when it means something to you.
Absolutely.
And so we've been able to use the data and have real-time conversations and make instructional shifts within a matter of days, not in a matter of years, which was the pattern for many school districts across the country for so long.
Yeah, the old bureaucracy holding up everything, even minor change.
Yeah.
Now, it's been discussed over and over by people in different school districts, different communities. What do you think are still some of the risk factors that make kids fail? Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it that's still missing?
Us as educators. And when I say what I'm about to say to you, I oftentimes get into a heated debate with folks. Haven't been that student with all the risk factors, haven't been that student with disabilities, poor, coming from areas that had traditionally not achieved, knowing the powerful impact that one educator can make, and then having more than one educator be in my life. And what I've seen as a professional educator, I see it as well also, we are the barrier. Uh-huh. Our own belief systems, our understandings, our expertise as far as how to be culturally responsive to our young people, how to design learning experiences that are relevant, that are going to engage and educate. We are the ones who control that. I am a true believer that every young person can achieve to the highest aspirations. Every young person can achieve. And the only thing standing in their way are the folks helping them, and that would be us.
Well, what about a lack of parental involvement? I hear that over and over again. The fathers aren't reading to the kids. Some kids don't have enough food. You know, I mean,
I hear all those things. And again, I get into heated debates. They aren't the primary indicator. If with all those things available or all those things present, a powerful educator can overcome that. A powerful school can overcome that.
Yeah.
And again, I say to folks all the time, we aren't teaching parents. We're teaching young people. So a five-year-old comes into our classrooms, we have all that human potential. And again, I couldn't talk very much until I was in ninth grade. I couldn't read very well until 10th grade. And here I am with 4 advanced degrees from the University of Virginia.
And so an educator came and helped you.
An educator
who
understood that I could communicate and understood that I could think and moved away all the barriers, everything from policies that wouldn't allow me to enroll in an honors class. I didn't have to have a prerequisite course or read over the summer in order to enroll in that class. They just put me there. Who also said, you don't have to multiply before you can divide. You don't have to multiply before I can have you do fractions and think algebraically. See, folks who understood that I could think first and appreciated and had high expectations for me and appreciated my intellect and removed all the barriers from their thinking were the reasons why I started to achieve. And so knowing it had went that long, it had gone on for that long for me personally, I know that it can, if we start early in fifth grade or preschool, having those kind of belief systems and expectations and that level of expertise as far as pedagogy, that we can do wonders for any young person.
So kids really need mentors, educators as mentors in many ways, right?
Yeah. Empowerment is one of our, it's part of our mission statement. We need to blur the lines between the teacher and the learner so that we're all learners. So we, whether you call that mentorship, education, what have you, but the lines need to be blurred. We need to build partnerships with young people and adults so that we're all learning together. That happened for me. That's what we're attempting to build in the city school district.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all of us through the years have heard about these incredible teachers and teaching, the setups for teaching in places like New York City where the kids were failing, but some magic educator comes in and changes the whole dynamic. It is amazing how one person, a great educator, can
Well, could you imagine if we had that in every classroom?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, you're a big proponent of incorporating technology education. You're a big pusher for that. Tell us about that.
And it comes back to my just fundamental belief in teaching and learning. I understand what it takes to engage young people, what the ultimate level of engagement looks like in classrooms. I understand how young people, how their brains are different now and what they expect as far as multimedia. We know, the research is very clear, young people are interacting with media 7 or 8 hours a day. And they come to school oftentimes and they have none. They're accustomed to working with tools and they want to have Wi-Fi access. They want to be able to go anywhere in the world. They want to be able to communicate and collaborate with young people all over the world. Therefore, we must adapt in what our classroom spaces and learning spaces look like. So if that's looking like an iPad, a cell phone, a laptop, wireless infrastructure, bandwidth, we must provide it for them.
But don't you worry about kids not interacting, lacking in social skills? I mean, that's what I hear a lot of teachers complaining about.
And that's,
kids are all wired up and they don't know how to talk to each other very well.
And that's, again, why we are more important than ever. We must facilitate the conversations to allow for them to interact with someone face-to-face, in a small group of one or two, but also be able to interact online when millions are reading what you write. Going forward, our young people are going to have to be able to communicate in 140 characters or less.
That's right.
Or communicate in social media forms where that's going to be available for everyone for the rest of their lives. So what you put out there today will be out there in 40 years when you're looking to work for IBM or Google, whatever company is that's available right then. So our jobs are very important now, is to help them understand how to socialize and communicate and collaborate in the different settings.
Yeah. So do you find that a lot of teachers have to come up to speed on that, too? I mean, not all teachers, especially ones that have been in the school district for 20, 25, 30 years.
All educators. What I will say is some of the most experienced educators are the most passionate and as far along on this continuum as I've ever seen. I'm seeing some 30-year vets who have a fundamental understanding of teaching and learning and how to engage young people and how to get them to collaborate and solve problems using the technology tools most effectively. And many of them rarely touch the tool. They allow the kids to facilitate the class, but they know which questions to ask, and they know what the expectations should be, and they allow kids to create. So we all, I know every day I'm learning. I'm taking it on myself to learn more and more about how to use social networking tools, digital tools, the various platforms, because we all are having to grow because things are changing so fast.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Lavelle Brown. He's the superintendent of the Ithaca City School District in Ithaca, New York. Tell us what your assessment is of No Child Left Behind, the new one called Race to the Top. What do you think of those programs? Are they helping? Are they hindering?
The intended purpose was good. What I'm seeing now are the unintended consequences are detrimental to what we're attempting to do. It's creating competition that's not healthy. Folks are moving more into silos versus helping one another and collaborating. We're competing for monies. We're talking charter schools versus public schools and not talking and learning from one another. So I think the intended purposes were good, but the unintended consequences aren't so good. The assessment programs that are high stakes in nature and are one-shot deals, and the number that many politicians and other folks are using or looking to as an indicator of whether or not a child or a school is achieving, that's wrong. I will never say, as a professional educator, that one indicator will give me any sense of how much a young person or a school is achieving. But yet these things that Race to the Top and the accountability systems that we have in place federally and at the state level are doing just that. So yeah. I'm struggling with it.
I know everybody who works in schools is struggling with this.
But my struggle is a challenge as well. What I say to folks is, it's now up to us as the folks who are struggling to show a different model. So in our school district, when we're building our own assessment model that's quarterly in common and going after critical thinking skills that gives us real-time information, that is a model that we can share with the state or the federal government and say, this is giving us better information and a better indicator of achievement. Yeah. When we talk about college and career readiness, when we're tracking our young people's proficiency in a second or third language, we're tracking their enrollment patterns in co-curricular and arts programming, college career readiness is much more that than a cut score on a state test. And right now, our state determines college and career readiness by a cut score on the annual assessment.
I see.
So if we want to be serious and talk about college and career readiness and thinking skills and achievement, let's look at the multiple indicators that our district is putting out there as a sense of achievement or portfolio of information versus the one indicator that some of these federal programs and state programs are asking us to put out.
But can you discount those from? Do you still have to?
We still have to do it. And again, they're one indicator, and they do provide valuable information, but just one. The high stakes nature of it, and the end all be all, and the dollars attached to it. That's where I struggle. And some of the assessments and some of the things that I'm seeing most recently come from this program are good.
Mm-hmm. It's not a total negative. A lot of teachers I know have complained about having to teach to the test, and there's a lot of cultural differences, and kids are not ready for some of these things. Mm-hmm. As you were talking about earlier, some kids don't learn in the same paces as they were supposed to. Eighth grade test,
It's hard, to be a proponent of personalized learning and customized opportunities and then give everyone the same assessment once a year.
Yeah. How have you dealt with racism in the school district? We know that's been a problem for many years. I've been here for 14 years, and I know it's been a problem forever.
Yeah, as an African-American male living here, I see it every day.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm not in my suit, I'm treated very differently than I am when I'm superintendent in a tie. But growing up where I grew, I'm accustomed to that. For me, I know that I will never change someone's belief systems in that way. What I can do is attempt to influence them and attempt to have folks be more culturally responsive, regardless of their internal belief systems. Because I'll never know what someone really thinks deep down in their heart.
Yeah.
But how they interact with a young person or a staff member or a colleague, we can have some influence over. So we have, for the last 2.5 years, we've done much around PD, around cultural competency, helping folks understand how to think differently because the person in front of them is thinking differently based on their cultural beliefs and where they're from. How do you respond? Which pedagogical shifts must I make in my classroom based on what the young people look like and where they're coming from?
Mm-hmm.
We spend a lot of time on that. We've had long, full-day staff development sessions, individual workshops, team workshops, school workshops around cultural responsiveness. We're also working to get at equity through policy. We have a gentleman, Dr. Sean F. Z. Bradwell, who's a board member who's chairing our policy committee, who is one of our community icons when it comes to equity issues and racist issues. We're changing policies to address the equity issues that existed based on past practices or racist beliefs from decades ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're working on it, and the things that we can control, we're working to control. But the things we can't control, when I think your question went after just racism deep in someone's heart, growing up around it all my life, I know you'll never be able to really change that.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. But I'm thinking about racism that actually affects kids
and
learning.
And we're after that.
Yeah. So, you know what I want to ask you too, Dr. Brown? All the time, every year, there are assessments about how the schools in Europe do better than our school. We're usually 19th or 20th. They have a more rigorous program. They're in school longer. There's not such emphasis on sports in many of these countries. Well, what do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the way they go about educating is fundamentally different from how we go about it. The amount of time and resources they put into teacher development programs and staff development once an educator is in the classroom is significantly more than what we do here.
Yeah.
I think that's key. The educators who are in classrooms in those foreign countries are some of the best and brightest in the country.
Yeah. And then they're even put on a track.
They're put on a pedestal
in
the community.
And only the brilliant ones get a chance to teach.
Mm-hmm. Only the brilliant get a chance. And here, I can't go into a grocery store anymore and look at a magazine rack without someone bashing education and teachers.
Yeah.
I struggle with that. And I watched my mother get beat up over it for decades. And I, as an educator, working hard every day, continue to get criticized for things that I have no control of or things that we probably shouldn't be criticized to be bashed for. So this is a tough profession here to be a part of.
It is.
And some of our best and brightest go on to do something different and make much more
money. I've always thought that we just don't have the cultural will to educate. You know, we're a rich country, and it almost feels like we haven't really thought we needed to educate the way Europeans do.
And there are some other differences, too. I think we do have the will and to educate. We're attempting to educate all young people. That alone is very unique compared to what some of the countries we're being compared to, who, after a certain amount of time, they have some young people not continue along with school.
Yeah.
And only their best and brightest continue with school. That's not the case here. So some of the data that we see coming from international comparisons is a bit skewed, because we're comparing all of our students to students that they've sort of tracked off.
Oh, yeah, and we also have a diverse country that we're talking about.
We have a diverse country, but
when you're talking about Sweden, it's much less diverse and a smaller population.
So, truly fundamentally different the way they're going about educating young people. And then again, we're looking at one indicator. Most of these are one test. The TIM study, some of these other international assessments, they're just one indicator of achievement. Here, I think co-curricular enrollment patterns are an indicator of achievement. And when you look at our statistics next to some of these international comparisons, they don't have young people enrolled in the arts and athletic programs.
Well, and in places like Germany, I know some of the kids that aren't going to be going into academia are pushed into the trades and trained, at least to have the skills to have jobs.
I think
that probably is, in some ways, the difference. Mm-hmm. Are you worried about the fact that arts is being cut in many schools? I know a lot of people think the arts are essential for our cultural soul.
Yeah, it breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. I did my dissertation, my doctoral work was in this area. I studied the impact arts and athletic programs had on young people's leadership, achievement, 10 different indicators. And I found that they did have an impact, a positive impact. And then I also looked at superintendents' perceptions. And what I found is most superintendents, when they look to eliminate things from the budget, would go to the arts and PE and athletic programs first, versus having that be the last thing they want to cut, because we know that has the biggest impact on achievement. So I'm very passionate about this particular area. And you will see in our district, we've grown our arts and music and athletic programs over the last few years, while most school districts in our state are eliminating programs.
Yeah, I haven't heard that they're eliminating athletics as much as arts.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Modified sports, JV sports, some entire sports teams. I mean, look here in the Ithaca City School District, we have girls ice hockey, for example. We have sports. We don't cut for some of our modified sports. We continue to add teams as we have an interest. So that's where you're seeing some of the cuts occurring that aren't as public as, you know, the varsity football team or the varsity basketball team. But some of those modified developmental programs are.
Yeah, and I also hear that recess has been cut, and that, you know, and then we go to talking about the obesity epidemic as tied to that. And,
but
like what you were just saying, a lot of people forget that athletics does teach leadership skills.
Very much.
And then learning to work in a team, literally.
You have to practice individually, practice with the team, and perform for an audience. Think of any profession in this country right now that we want our young people to go into where they wouldn't have to do those three things. And I know as an athlete and as someone who did an instrument for a little while, that's where I learned how to do it best. Practice as an individual, work hard, work well with my teammates, and then perform when the lights are on. And that's what you get from those activities.
Yeah. Now, there's always been this debate whether we want to educate our kids to be employees or to have critical thinking and creativity being able to flourish in schools. Well, what do you think about that? Should we be teaching kids just to have skills so that they can become workers?
We should be teaching kids the skills to be thinkers. I'm reading research and I'm seeing more from my own personal experience. Entrepreneurship is what we need to be preparing young people for going forward. That's going to be our economy's driver going forward. The word workers, I'm unsure what that's going to mean in the future, but I do know that thinking and thinkers are going to be needed more and more. I mean, we don't know what jobs are going to exist in the next 10 years. We don't know what problems that are going to exist in the next 10 years. So preparing young people to think and solve complex problems and analyze complex information and communicate well and work collaboratively with diversity, those are the skills that are embedded in our curriculum and in our work every day. And I think those skills are going to have to carry on for many, many decades going forward.
I understand that you're a very popular speaker around the state. But what kind of subjects do you talk about? Just what we're talking about today? Or do you have specific things that you want to
Quite a few topics. I talk about this approach to using technology tools to engage young people and to adapt to the needs of our learners today. I talk about the fundamental skills, any sensory skills, which I just described, those analytical, complex, solving complex problems, writing well, communicating. What does that mean specifically mm-hmm. for young people, and how does that translate into classrooms, and what does it look like for large organizations like ours to have that embedded in its culture? So I talk about that some. Then I just do some motivational speaking. I'm blessed to be here. Most guys I grew up with a cohort of 11 gentlemen, all African-American males in a rural town poor. And myself and my brothers are the only one left. We're the only ones left.
What do you mean by that?
They all passed away
really?
In one way or the other. And that's happened because of educational opportunities that were available to myself and my brother that weren't available to them, is what I truly believe. So I speak about how that occurred and what systems, policies, and structures that have been in place to create that situation. And we grew up in the 80s and the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I see the same policies and structures and systems in place today in 2013. And I have a son at home. And I know if I'm not able to navigate these systems well, and I should know as a superintendent, he could very much end up like my boy, my best friend,
yeah.
who because of systems his parents and he couldn't navigate, things started to spiral out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And I told this story, I was pretty much the runner of the group. I was the shortest, the worst athlete, and I was the one who struggled to learn the most. But because I was with great educators, my mother had some sense of how to navigate the system, I'm here. And I'm now superintendent, and I have 4 advanced degrees, and I'm speaking to folks.
Yeah.
Whereas the guys who were much more talented than me, who didn't have those that help, they struggled. And one thing led to another, and they're not here anymore.
Yeah, that is so sad. And it's still happening, especially among African-American men.
Yeah.
You
mm-hmm.
know, the mm-hmm. culture does not treat African-American men well. I mean, even Michelle Obama mm-hmm. said that she worries about Barack going to fill his gas tank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
if they don't know who he is.
And it's bigger than African-American males. And from my work, I see it now. All membership groups that are at risk.
Absolutely.
If you're poor right
yeah,
now,
yeah,
the structures
yeah.
and policies in place that prevents you from achieving. Gender, I've seen policies
yeah.
and structures in place that keep women or males in certain situations.
Yeah, and out of certain
areas
of certain like the sciences.
Yeah.
Girls aren't good at math. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I understand what you mean by that, too. We're running out of time now. How are you dealing with drugs in schools? I wanted to touch on that topic, too.
That's what... And this is not a fairly new phenomenon, but it's rather new to us because it's becoming more and more open and more young people are being affected by it. And now I'm going to be looking to parents to help.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm finding in my role is oftentimes the culture in the home is leading to young people's belief that it can be this drug usage can take place in and out of school. Because, the drug usage doesn't start in school.
No.
It's coming from outside, and I'm seeing that too. I'm confident saying that. So we are reaching out to families and the community to help us with this issue because it is an issue, and it's an issue nationally. We've seen a statistic from here in Tompkins County where it's becoming more and more prevalent here in our county. It's something we must address because it's a distraction to the powerful work we're doing, and it's holding many of our young people back from achieving their wildest dreams.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dr. Lavelle Brown, we are almost out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so glad you're in place in our school district. It sounds like you're doing a fabulous job. Thank you.
Excited to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.